not like a tape recorder where you push a button and it just goes.
The problem here is upcalls. But more generally, the problem is that you have a party you must not block trying to send a notification to a party you may not be listening and may never be listening. Okay? And it's not just a security issue, it's a robustness issue. So what we need here is some kind of non-blocking message. Okay? But non-blocking messages are bloody tricky. Okay? Because we also need to make sure that this cannot require any allocation of storage. Okay? So whatever message we're going to send, it's got to happen in storage that the mere existence of the sender and the receiver all tells us we've got the necessary storage to send the message. Now, a possible alternative would be to say, look, we'll invent some kind of a first-class message. We'll set things up so the receiver will allocate a first-class message block, okay, hand it to the sender, and the sender can requeue this message every now and then. Right? I mean, that would be viable. So we could do storage allocation by prior arrangement. But we can't do storage allocation in time of message. And we want the storage, in this case, to be paid for by the lower reliance party. Lower reliance meaning less trusted, less secure, less robust, any of these. And so we end up with sort of these two design options. Okay. First is first class messages. Now, first class messages is actually not a new idea. It's an idea that goes back to Hydra, if I remember correctly. Okay. This does not mean the message is buffered. Yes, it is the case that the message is buffered here. It means that the message has identity independent of the identity of the sender and the receiver. So what it means for a message to be first class is I could pass you that message and you would receive it, and having received it, you might then pass the message to another party and it would be identically the same message in some recognizable way. In this case, it turns out that first class messages isn't really going to help, because the problem we have here isn't actually the storage. We can set up a shared memory arrangement in all the cases here that we found. So it's not the payload of the message that's the issue. It's the notification. Right? It's the fact that the receivers, we have to have a way to transmit this message in such a way that the sender doesn't block. Even if the message were first class, the capability to it has to get copied. Okay? Or the message has to move from one queue to another. So, the other option is this notification idea. So the idea here is to say, look, we're just going to make it part of the process state that every process has a little bit mask. It's fixed length. Some number of bits, say 32, 64, I don't care, a small number. Okay? And we're going to have an operation probably requiring different authority from a message sender, although I'm not 100% sure about that, that allows a sender to post a bit. This is like sending a signal, except the idea isn't trying to model hardware interrupts, which is where signals originally came from. And it's not preempted. Okay, so what happens if the same bit gets posted twice? You don't know that it happened twice on receiving side. So the guarantee if I post is the receiver will get notified about that bit at least once. Well, no, if the receiver dies, may not get the message. But assuming the receiver survives, right? The bit will go to the receiver at least once. But if two parties post at the same time, there's no guarantee the receiver will get notified twice. So the notion is that what we're going to do is we're going to store this bit mask, and we're going to add a mechanism in the kernel. And by the way, I'm not happy about adding this mechanism. It's a hairball. And there are two ways to do it. One is to say, look, when the process comes to the endpoint, it says, I'm ready to receive a message. There are two ways we can go here. One is to say, we're going to reserve a piece of payload in the outcoming message that says, and by the way, in addition to the message that came in, here are your pending event gates. Do something about them. And whoever asks next, that's who gets it. The other option is to say, well, we don't want to introduce a pending events mask. What we'll do instead is we'll synthesize from the kernel a distinguished message, which simply contains those bits as its message payload. And when I come to the receive endpoint, if there are pending notification bits, the kernel will simply synthesize a message containing the notification bits and tell me what they are, but I'll get them separate from any other message that might be coming. And either one of these mechanisms will work. Okay. And so the point here is that the storage for this bit mask was pre-allocated. In the Eros design, you put it in the receiving process because there's no first-class endpoint. In the endpoint design, you probably put it in the endpoint. Okay. And the sender can post these bits and can go merrily on their way, right, with no sort of further ado. Now, if you go back to the situation with the Ethernet driver, right, you had this mess with the IRQ helper, which basically was ping-ponging back and forth, reversing the flow of the messages, so that instead of waiting for an interrupt, the Ethernet driver got called to be told that there was an interrupt. And then above this, we had TCP/IP, and I think, I'm not sure what called it the IP helper, but I don't remember what he actually called it. Right, the IP helper was really dealing with this problem of upward notification, that the Ethernet wanted to tell the IP stack, look, it would be good if you could come to read some of your packets, because I'm about to start throwing them away. And each of these is an upcall. Now, if we had a way to post a notify, then this thing can go away in favor of an upward notify. The key requirement is that it be non-blocking. In fact, if we had a notify, then strictly speaking, we could do a notify in this direction as well. Right? So the kernel could push the interrupt notification up to the driver code, and at that point you can get rid of the IRQ helper as well. Now that's a little trickier, but it's doable. And that's one of the changes we're doing in Coyotes, which I've said. And it's one of these things, so this is one of these places where, you know, you violate architectural, the architectural equivalent to the 80-20 rule or the 90-10 rule. This is one of these things where, in a properly designed system, there's a very, very short list of places you're going to use this mechanism. It's well under 1% of the cases. Okay, but it's critical, because the places where you are using it are absolutely performance critical places, and content switches matter in these places. Okay. So that was part of what I wanted to talk about. The other part of what I wanted to talk about was this issue of the incoming message buffer. Off on the side, you have some Ethernet hardware. And that Ethernet hardware is, in modern chipsets, is doing PMA. So the way to think about this Ethernet hardware is that there's a ring buffer of incoming packet slots. And the Ethernet hardware is going to deliver into that ring buffer whether you like it or not. Okay. So Another way to say this is, yes, there's still a FIFO in the hardware, but the FIFO has actually been extended out into main memory, and it's going to try to put packets directly into main memory. Now, at this point, you have two possible designs. The first says, look, that DMA is sunk cost. I can't do anything about it. And if I'm not doing programmed I/O, if I'm not actually reading the packet one by one, the first opportunity that I'm going to get to run a packet filter is when I look at the packet in the buffer. And so now there are two feasible designs. The first says, well, I'm going to run DPF on the packet in the buffer, and I'm going to conditionally copy the packet to the right outbound buffer. So here's the application IP receive buffer. This buffer is going to be allocated by the application exactly the way that the Windows system buffer was. And we're going to make a packet filter decision about where to copy the packet out to. Okay, and then just as we get in the Windows system, there's a risk during the copy step that we'll take a fault, an exception, if the application has reneged. But that's the only place we'll take that exception, because that's the only place we're touching application memory, and we'll recover from that. Okay. But this design does not achieve zero copy. Right? If you're really careful, it can achieve zero copy downward, but not upward. The way it can achieve zero copy downward is on the send side, if we see a packet and if we have sufficient privilege, we can contrive to piece the relevant frames before putting them into the hardware outbound DMA queue. And then we really can do zero copy. Although I have to tell you, it's not clear if that pays, because the cost to go in and out of the kernel to pin the frames is not a small cost. You might be better copying than that. Not obvious. But you're going to end up doing single copy on the way out. Now, there's two ways to accomplish the copy, and this is the kind of interesting. I mean, one is obviously you can move the bytes. The second is to arrange your inbound DMA so that each packet lands on a new page. And you know by virtue of the Ethernet specification that the packet frame size is smaller than the page size. So you know you won't go off the end of the page. And then instead of implementing the copy with a byte exchange, you might actually be able to implement the copy with a page flip. A frame exchange. Here again, though, you're going to have to enter the kernel to do that, and it's not immediately obvious that you were better off at that point versus just doing that. My intuition is, hey, if you have a trainload of packets, you can analyze them all and build up a vector of exchanges you want to do, and then drop into the kernel once and do the vector of exchanges all in one go. Then that's probably okay. If you're doing just one, you know, at 1,000 cycles to get in and out of the kernel, you might as well copy the bytes. Okay. So there's a performance issue here. And ironically, this is one of those cases where if you decide that the right performance answer is to copy the bytes, the humor of this is, if that's the case, you might be better off not using the DMA engine, because once you're going to copy the bytes anyway, rather than copying them from memory to memory, you might just want to copy them direct from hardware to memory, and then you can actually do the filter on the fly and put them in the right place. So there's some low-level engineering here that's actually very tricky and well beyond what's being done in most of the current Ethernet drivers. As a practical matter, I don't think anybody's ever going to do that engineering, because overriding the performance issue is the compatibility issue. Right? And the current behavior of Linux drivers says, oh, we're going to take all these packets, we're going to put them into an in-kernel buffer, and we're just going to pass the buffers by reference using the skbuf mechanism up the TCP/IP stack, and we're going to rely on the fact that this is all inside one address space. On the upward side, think about zero copy. So notice Linux doesn't get zero copy out either. Linux gets single copy. On the way up, right, a packet might make it, all the way to the top of the TCP stack without the bytes being copied. Okay, but once you go to make the move from the kernel layer up into the application layer, you have to do a copy out of those bytes. So you're going to do a copy somewhere. The only question is where. And if you took the view that that's the place where you're going to do the copy out, well, then look, this thing can do the same number of copies in exactly the same place. The question then becomes, why separate the IP stack and the Ethernet logic? And the answer is the IP stack is complicated, the Ethernet logic is complicated, why marry them? Right? The fewer lines of code I have to analyze to determine what parts of the system are recoverable, the happier I'm going to be. And the argument is that by isolating the Ethernet, I can isolate the piece of code that must have access to physical DNA. I'm not completely convinced, by the way. The argument in the other direction would be, look, the physical DMA issues have nothing to do with how big a program I'm running. They have to do with what DMA I'm talking to. Okay, and I can run the DMA state machine on a big program and on a little program, and it's both the same one. And if you believe that story, then maybe the answer is, you should just integrate all the networking stuff and not try to separate it, because your unit of failure, right? The question is, what's your unit of failure and what's the complexity of your dynamic validating testing tool that checks this behavior? It's not the size of the code, it's the size of the stuff that you have to inspect and assure for robustness or security. Which might not be the whole application in this case, because we're using a separate checking mechanism. Okay, so that was basically what I wanted to say on the Ethernet topic to close the loop on it. I'm happy to take questions on this or on anything else that you guys want to talk about. And I'm also happy to say, have a nice holiday. So let's sort of pause long enough to see if people have questions.
When you were mentioning, when you were talking about asbestos, you mentioned that you could cache port levels with respect to global center, receive levels. I don't quite understand how that works.
More than just port levels. So here's the intuition. At the end of the day, what's happening is a comparison between two labels, between two sets of compartment comma level pairs. Now, the question to ask yourself is, how can those labels be altered? What are the ways in which they can be altered? And the observation is, well, the vast majority of those alterations go upwards. There is a downgrade mechanism, but I suspect it's very rarely used. So suppose I do a check, and now what I know is, here's an in label, here's an out label, here's a boolean, yes or no, this is permitted. Here's the observation. If the out labels levels rise, the boolean doesn't change. Because the requirement is that the out label has to be greater than the in label. Okay? The only time I have to revalidate is if the in label changes. Okay, so the argument in general is that label changes are actually surprisingly rare. My belief is that in pragmatically useful systems, the label relationships, they bounce around initially, and then they stabilize, and then they remain stable. Because if that's not true, think about what happens if that's not true. If that's not true, we're going to be constantly invalidating all of the protection state of the operating system. And it doesn't matter at that point whether it's labels or cryptographic keys or peanut butter sandwiches or Oreo cookies. If we're invalidating the state of the operating system all the time, we have not got a viable system design. It may not be that the operating system is broken. We may have picked an application that's not viable, but from a performance perspective, it's a dud. Okay, so either the label stabilized or the whole idea doesn't make any sense. If the label is stabilized, then caching is useful, and then the question becomes, well, what do I have to do to know that I've got to invalidate the cache? Okay, there are two caches I need. The first is I need the combination cache that when I'm doing these combined labels lets me quickly find what's the effective label. And the second is, I need a cache that says, here was the in label, here was the out label, what was the answer? Because these labels could have a very large number of compartments in them, and what I really don't want to do is re-execute the compartment check. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions?
Yeah, the first question on the
is,
I don't remember exactly what it is, but it's something like, you discussed several ways of wrapping the capability in a persistent system.
Okay.
I was wondering if you could maybe say what the context was when we talked about that in class. I'm having trouble remembering that.
Fair enough. So one that I talked about was the notion of a capability that's going to go to a wrapper object. Okay, and the wrapper object then is going to go to the destination. And that wrapper can be completely translucent. Except that, so the sort of logical message flow goes across the wrapper without alteration. Okay, except that I could have a reference monitor on the side that's in a position to sever that wrapper or potentially to redirect it. Another variation on the theme, if I don't want to have it just be an on-off switch, if I actually want to validate the messages as they go through for some reason, then I can have the destination be the reference monitor, and the reference monitor can conditionally forward the message. The key point about having the wrapper here is I can sever the connection. Another useful property about the wrapper is if I don't want the reference monitor to have to store billions of capabilities, I can actually arrange to stash in the wrapper the real destination capability in such a way that the sender can't get it, but it will be delivered to the reference monitor, so in the same moment where the reference monitor is evaluating whether to forward the message, it has directly in hand the destination to go to if it concludes the message is okay. So that was one.
The wrapper object, is that like a process or?
In the Rust implementation, it's a node.
Okay.
Underneath the covers. I mean, it's a node. The capability type of this node says wrapper.
Okay.
There's a similar thing you can do with endpoints, but in the current specification, endpoints don't have any auxiliary storage. So, for example, you can't currently stash a capability in them. And I've been coming slowly to the conclusion that we're going to need to do something like wrappers in Coyotes. I don't like that. I really hoped to get out of doing wrappers. But it might be that the way to resolve this is to augment the possible state of an endpoint. But there's a couple of design patterns that seem really useful here, mostly for avoiding extra storage issues, that seem, it's not obvious how to reproduce them with endpoints. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
You also spoke about wrappers when you were talking about RAND for processes.
Yes, although that's a special case. So one case is I have an application and I have a process capability to some process P. And I have some brand capability, and I'm trying to identify the process. And so I also have to have what in Kikos was called the can opener And basically I say, here's the process, here's something I think is the brand, yes or no. Okay? And there's a similar operation if I'm working through a wrapper. Okay? Now the rationale for this, the case of the wrapper, the two rationales are very close. The idea is, look, the party who created the process better hold tight to the brand. Okay? And in this case, the design model is the wrapper logically is associated with its destination. And here again, the party who created the destination better hold tight to the brand. Other questions?
Yeah. So for the notification bid scheme, by what mechanism does the receiver get out of having to pull more true bids?
Oh, what's going to happen? So what's the scenario where the receiver wasn't going to accept a message? The scenario is the receiver was processing something. At some point later, and we don't really care when or if, because I mean the receiver could be busted, so later could be never. Okay, but assuming the receiver continues to operate, at some point the receiver is going to say, "Good, I'm going to wait for my next message now," and that's the point at which we'll provide the notify. Okay. So this is a non-preemptive, non-blocking notify. There's an open issue here, which is there do appear to be situations where you really want a watchdog timer. The only general situation I've seen where preemption is actually well motivated. And you run into a bit of an architectural problem. So one is just, it's a complication. But the other architectural problem is if you build the preemption mechanism into the IPC, what will happen is people will use it. And we talked about that, right? This is one of these catch-22s. You have to have it, but you really don't want to make it too easy to use.
Any question about the asbestos? Linking the name, the event processes. Is the label of an event process the least upper bound of all of these pages?
No. I don't, at least, let me be careful.
I don't understand.
So the answer is I don't know, and I don't actually know the details about how the event process mechanism is working. But here's my guess. But let me qualify this by saying this is what I would have done, and I have no idea if it's what they did.
Okay, because I didn't find any descriptions reading the paper.
Okay. So here's, I think, the right thing to do, or at least one possible right thing to do, but whether this is what they did, I couldn't tell you. And the reason I'm sort of pushing in this direction may be driven by knowing what we did in the Eros implementation, and prior to that in the Kikos implementation, and now in the Kyotos implementation. So here's the situation. You have an event process, and you'd like to think that this thing has an address space, but in general, it's got an address space with funny kinds of holes in it, places where pages are present, and they may even be present with the right permissions in the sense that a read operation or a write operation would be okay. But their label prohibits that operation from actually going forward, the label of the page. So this is a very kind of funny kind of present but not accessible. One way to do that, and notice that until the event process actually does an operation and puts it in conflict with the labeling policy, we don't care. The mere presence of a high labeled page in my address space is not a source of hazard. The hazard comes when I read it. Or conversely, on my right. So one way you could handle this is you could say, okay, over here, okay, I'm going to have the real address space. I don't mean real in the sense of real versus virtual. I mean this is the definitive address space.
Base.
What?
Base address space. Base process.
I don't want to call it that. Definitive. Okay. So this describes the state of the address space with all the label information. But it does not describe the subset of this address space that I can currently access. And now what we'll do is, as the we'll give the event process another address space, which is ephemeral. It's a cache. It's going to get constructed on the fly in response to page faults. Okay. And what we'll do is, as the event process proceeds, it will incur page faults in this shadow page table space. Okay, so this thing on the left is known in the literature as a shadow page table. And the idea was invented in the context of virtual machines, where you have a real hardware page table, right, and you have the page table of the emulated subsystem, which isn't really on the hardware, but you can make it look like it is. Okay. So basically, on demand, as faults occur in the shadow page table, we check the labels in the source page table, and conditional on the label answer, we update the shadow page table and then allow the reference to proceed. And updating the shadow page table might mean, hey, I just noticed that the CP has just done a reference to a high labeled page, and before I update the page table entry in the shadow page table, I'm going to reset the EP's label, the send label, right, to the least upper bound of the two labels, right, which would be below that policy applied locally. And only after doing that will I validate read access to the page. Okay. So now what happens is that the EP will stay at the lowest label that's permitted, consistent with the references it actually does. So that would be the technique, and there are, you know, 40 optimizations on this technique, all, you know, 30 of which you actually have to do to make this run well, 25 of which are actually not widely published. So, which is actually something I'm trying to fix today. So, does that answer your question now? Now, whether they actually did this, I don't know. The sort of chain of inference that I'm drawing is, they said in the earlier paper that they had labels and page granularity. Okay, the whole point of the event process was that you could downgrade an event process and that as long as it didn't touch the bad pages, it would be okay. If you take these two statements together, the only mechanism I know of that's capable of handling this is something like a shadow page table. That's it. And you can do a good bit better than this. And the other thing to say is, so when you downgrade the EP, you whack the shadow page table. You throw it out. Right? You can do a little bit better than that. Very often it'll turn out that like the code space of the EP is low label and it's read-only, and that's okay. And so what you'll actually do, you won't actually whack the shadow page table. What you'll actually do is you'll sever the master page directory pointer, but you'll leave the existing page tables in place. But over in the side information for the page table, you'll keep a record. What's the current least upper bound label for that page table? Right. So then what you'll discover is, after the sever, the first reference to the page directory is expensive, because you have to allocate a new page directory at the right label level, but then it goes to grab the page table. If you've done your bookkeeping right, before it builds a new page table, it'll say, oh, I might already have a page table whose least upper bound is accessible. If so, I can just grab it, boom, I've just revalidated the next 1,000 pages. Right? That's the kind of caching trick I'm talking about. And it's a variation of one that we're using in the RS kernel. It works for us. It reduces the cost of fork by a factor of about 1,000, which is why I think it matters. It's the key to making event process effective. Yeah.
It's possible that I misread this paragraph in the paper. This is Brian Madison. I have difficulty understanding what's going on. But it didn't seem like the page table was being whacked, because the event process actually had discrete control over which pages it would whack while it was running. And
Okay, one thing I'm sure about, the shadow page, if the event process gets downgraded, the shadow page table must get separate. It's not optional. Must. Either that, or the implementation is wrong. Pick one.
Yeah.
Or they're using some other mechanism. I mean, they could conceivably be using a more expensive mechanism. But this group that wrote this paper, you guys are not dumb. They know this basic techniques. As to the fine grain control, I don't. My memory of it isn't solid enough.
It's just all part of a single paragraph.
Yeah,
and that's why I'm having.
Yeah. So one of the things that I hope they will do in a future publication is talk about how they deal with this mechanism, because I'm guessing.
Okay.
And I would like to know what they do. All right. Have a good holiday. Exams due on Friday. I will acknowledge my email, just so you don't worry. I'm down to DARPA meeting on Friday, so my acknowledges will come by Friday evening. So, you know, just don't expect me instantaneously, it's not going to happen. Sorry. Do me a favor, put something really noteworthy, like all caps exam, in the subject line, because I don't want to misplace them, because what happens is very quickly some of you will say, oh, that was my last exam, I'm going home for the holidays. I really would like to be in a position to give you a grade, so if something goes wrong, I want to be able to catch up with you. I don't want to just lose it in a flow. Okay? Thank you.